If you'd like to receive this podcast early and without ads, consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Listeners to this show can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience and early access, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, and an invitation to join the DSR Slack community. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code NOJOKE to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code NOJOKE. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, April 6th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, your host. This is the time of week we talk about the law and politics. We're delighted to be joined by one of our favorite guests and friends, Allison Gill, who is the owner of MSW Media and host of Jack, a Special Counsel podcast, The Daily Beans, and Cleanup on Aisle 45. How are you doing today, Allison?
I'm doing good, David. It's good to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you. Just as we're coming on the air recording this, we got some breaking news, and so I thought we should address that. New York Attorney General has filed a request for more information on the guy who provided, or the company who provided, the bond for Trump. Because he didn't provide enough information and he's out of state. And let's be honest, he's a pretty shady dude. So I was just wondering what your take was on this.
Well, as a Navy veteran who was the target of one of these predatory subprime car loans from the king of subprime car loans, I have a little bit of full disclosure. I don't like this guy. But apparently what happened was, you know, when they first filed the bond, Knight Insurance, which is owned by this Hanky fellow, they didn't provide a financial statement. And everyone was like, huh, that's weird. And now it seems obvious why they didn't. Because when they did, we find that they don't have enough cash on hand to cover the amount of the bond. And since they aren't backed, since Knight Insurance isn't registered with New York's financial services, and they aren't covered by New York, that gives the New York Attorney General the right to ask for more information to back this bond. I think they have 10 days to do it. She's filed this objection with the court. Now, Judge Engoron hasn't granted it yet. I don't see any reason he won't grant it. But we may get more information forthcoming about Knight Insurance's ability to actually cover this bond or not. So we'll see.
As I understand it, the request that she's filed would have them come in 10 days and present. I think the president of the company is cited in this. And if they were not able to meet the requirements for backing up this bond, as I understand it, Trump would then have to go and find somebody else to do it, which he has not been terribly successful at to this point. Do you have any idea how much time he would get? Is this just another stalling tactic?
Well, I think it was the best he could come up with, probably. I assume the court would afford him like probably 10 days to go find another insurer, show somebody to back the bond. I don't envision Judge Engoron here immediately allowing the New York Attorney General to start seizing assets. I'm assuming for due process reasons, he would have a little bit of time to come up with somebody who actually had the cash on hand to back this bond. But, you know, I think the larger picture is that no one wants to back this bond that has the money. And Trump, if he had the cash, he would back it himself. And the other great thing is that all of these things will likely be revealed in Barbara Jones's next report to the court. She is the fiscal monitor assigned to the Trump Organization. And with her new expanded role that Judge Engoron laid out recently, Trump is required to report to her all of the attempts that he has made to secure a bond. So I think it's all probably going to come out in the wash sooner or later. Attempt to delay, everything is an attempt to delay, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, this company, which does these kind of subprime loans and schemes and all sorts of kind of shady stuff, is about one cut above sort of Jimmy the Nose, your neighborhood loan shark, right? I mean, he's like gone through all the banks. He's gone through all the bond broke, the bondsmen who are out there. Suffice it to say, or do you tell me, it's not too much of a reach to say this could get kind of sticky for him.
I think it might. Yeah. And there could be. There could be legal repercussions for making misrepresentations on legal forms. I mean, the possibilities are endless here with respect to trying to shore up this bond for Donald Trump. And the fact that it was even lowered made me very angry. I don't understand, you know, nobody else gets that kind of deference when they're it's like people in prison on bail who can't come up with the bail. Too bad, you got to stay there. So even with this lowered, I think improperly lowered bond amount, it seems like he's still having a hard time coming up with the money. He had a real hard time coming up with the $91 million for E. Jean Carroll, eventually put up an entire Schwab account backed by the Chubb Group, which is one of those more legitimate insurance firms, and even though he had appointed the CEO of the Chubb Group to a nice position in the Trump administration, which is an odd backwards quid pro quo, but Chubb Group is definitely, I think, more legitimate than Mr. Hankey's the king of subprime car loans, Knight Insurance. But it'll be interesting to see. I think that Trump is having a really difficult time backing this bond, and I think he will continue to have a very difficult time doing so.
Yeah, but weirdly, here you have Hinky Hanky, and he's not the weirdest, worst, shadiest deal that Trump has in the news this week. Because for sure, that is taking Truth Social, merging it with this SPAC, losing $3 billion in value the moment people realize that Truth Social is a much weaker company than, shall we say, your company, in the sense that it had $4 million in sales and $59 million in losses. It is not a going concern by any measure. And the notion that it's worth billions of dollars is ridiculous. But wait, it gets worse, because Truth Social was propped up last year by a couple of sleazy dudes who are associated with an indicted Russian slimeball who is another Trump associate. You're going to have to start another podcast. I want to be the first to tell you there is going to be, this is going to be a whole new case, because this is one of the shadiest big financial deals I've ever seen.
Yeah, no, there's no way it's valued anywhere near $5.9 billion going lower every day. There's absolutely no way. I have friends who used to, advise people on junk bonds and the penny stocks. And he's like, I've never seen something so overvalued before. I mean, it's no different to me than selling NFTs or sneakers that haven't been made yet, or hawking $60 Bibles during Holy Week, or any of the Trump University, Trump steaks, Trump wine. I mean, it's all a house of cards. And when it gets down to it, when you're before a court and you actually have to show that you have money and legitimacy, he's been unable to do it at every turn. So I think that we're gonna really get to see what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, he did help everybody know that this was coming because he used the DJT stock symbol, which has been used in the past for other failed Trump enterprises, like his, when he tried to bring his Atlantic City casinos public, et cetera, et cetera. DJT is, it's kind of a message to the stock market. Do not go here. Buyer beware.
In Atlantic City, he had his dad come in and buy millions of dollars worth of chips and then just leave so that he could have some cash to pay rent or whatever. I mean, he's been doing this shell game, shiesty business stuff, propped up, by the way, from government loans.
Oh, it's even worse than that. I'll tell you a brief story. When I was running Foreign Policy Magazine, we got an investigative journalist in because I thought we would do hard-hitting journalism. And Trump was running for president. I said, there's got to be something here. He's a horrible guy. And we were actively trying to make that known to the world. And so the guys went off for 10 weeks and he came back and he said, here's what I found. In Atlantic City, Donald Trump had to pay off the Philadelphia mob. And so in order to do that, what he did was he bought the house of the son of the head of the Philadelphia mob for like 10 million bucks when it was worth like 2 million bucks. But it was completely legal. And so, he never got around to writing the story because it was just all the way up at the far end of shady, but inches away from the point of illegality. And that's where he lives. That's his zone.
It's money laundering. He did it with Rob Lavlev, who paid twice as much of the actual value of one of Trump's properties in Florida and then turned around and sold it for half. It's all a money laundering operation. Department of Justice is seizing an apartment in Trump International this week. They're asking for permission to do that because the person who owns it is a money launderer from Congo.
Well, the real estate business in Manhattan, for people like Trump, is largely a money laundering business. People who have hot cash from other countries come and they buy apartments in New York City, which are semi-liquid. They don't live in them. It's just a way of storing cash outside the reach of their own country.
Of course, yeah. And no one lived in this apartment for 2 years that the DOJ is asking permission to seize. But that's interesting that you talk about the investigative reporter you brought on. I immediately thought of Harlan Crow buying Clarence Thomas's mom's house for her.
Well, this is the way this happens. There's a lot of this stuff. There's just a playbook for how do you skirt the law and commit bribery? How do you skirt the law and, grease the palms of the mafia? It's the whole New York real estate business is about that. And that's why when Donald Trump ran for president, I think 11% of Manhattanites voted for Donald Trump because they knew they've been seeing it. They knew that this guy was hanging out in this sleazy world. So here's Donald Trump, and he's got all of these legal cases against him. And I think we can fairly assume there will be more for just the reasons we're talking about. There's still a few election shenanigan cases that are out there. But the worst of all the cases against Donald Trump, from his perspective, is the one that is most cut and dry, where he's committed the most heinous crime against the United States, or certainly one of the most heinous crimes against the United States, trafficking in national security secrets, and he's caught dead to rights. And then not only is he caught dead to rights, but then he obstructs justice after getting caught dead to rights. And now he's awaiting trial on this. The only thing that stands between him and justice is Judge Eileen Cannon, who, you know, came from the Judge Judy School of, you know, legal scholars, was a Trump supporter, and has been very deftly playing a game with this case where she doesn't do anything that can get overruled. She just does stuff that will delay the trial and tips her hand that she's buying into Trump's absurd arguments. And all that came, maybe, I don't know, you tell me, to a screeching halt this week as a result of a filing by your favorite imaginary friend, Jack Smith. And so I'm just wondering what your sense of that is.
Yeah, pretty big important filing from Jack Smith. Basically, Judge Cannon had asked both parties, based on an argument a Trump lawyer made in a hearing on March 14th about jury instructions and whether or not a president, simply by taking documents home, designates them as personal records and therefore are beyond the reach of the government, all based on that argument. What we saw happen was that Jack Smith filed that she wanted them to write jury instructions based on this misunderstanding and misinterpretation of the Presidential Records Act, which has nothing to do with this case, by the way. Presidential Records Act doesn't govern national defense information. There's an executive order that governs it.
And by the way, the Presidential Records Act says the opposite of what they say it says, right?
Of course it does. Everything says the opposite of what they say it does. Marbury v. Madison, the Constitution, whatever document. And so I was thinking to myself, well, you know, there's two options here. Either Jack Smith can go to the 11th Circuit with asking for a writ of mandamus, which is for the 11th Circuit to order Judge Cannon to do something or not do something, and basically order her to not require this ridiculous jury instruction exercise based on hypothetical misinterpretation of the law. Or he can, I thought maybe he would write a brief, which was due on April 2nd. He would write a response to her order saying, I'm not going to entertain a misinterpretation of the law. If you think that this is what the law says and that the Presidential Record Act applies here and applies inappropriately, then you need to dismiss these charges. I thought perhaps he would do that. It came sort of somewhere in the middle, because Jack Smith did indeed say, you are way wrong on the law. So I've written an actual jury instruction for you based on the correct interpretation of the law. But since you are ordering me to write these two weird hypothetical situations that the earth is flat, I'll go ahead and do that. Again, you know, basically against all good judgment. And then in those jury instructions, he inserts all sorts of great little sort of sassy things like, in this incorrect interpretation of the law, and keeping in mind that Donald Trump didn't have eyes only, you know, this, didn't have the right to do this, didn't have the right to do that, and that the PRA doesn't apply, here is your jury instruction based on what Judge Cannon said. He also put in this filing that she needs to decide and determine this now before we impanel a jury at trial, because at that point, double jeopardy would attach and you would, you know, basically totally derail this prosecution for no good reason based on a misinterpretation of the law. You need to decide now so that I can take you to the 11th Circuit and appeal it. So it was a very, he's made some pretty bold filings in the past. He's threatened to go to the 11th Circuit, particularly if you'll remember the reconsideration motion. She wants to release a bunch of names of witnesses and their testimony. And he said, if you do that, you are making a clear error of the law, manifest injustice will attach, and I will take you to the 11th Circuit. So he has threatened this before, but now he's threatening to go to the 11th Circuit with a writ of mandamus if she fails to do this. And Roger Parloff did a really good piece in Lawfare about all the times the DOJ has taken a writ of mandamus up the chain for ridiculous jury instructions. And so I think that it'll be interesting to see how the judge responds to this. If she does, she's been sitting on that reconsideration motion. She's been fully briefed on that for a really long time. and is just sitting on it because she knows if she rules improperly, she's going to the 11th Circuit. She may just sit on this, you know?
And for how long? How long does he let that happen? She hasn't set a trial date. She hasn't even made any of the decisions that you have to make in order to set a trial date. You know, her game is, well, this might not happen for 2 years, so I don't have to address this thing for a year.
She's got 13 motions on a secret docket that we can't see and responses that she hasn't ruled on.
So, but the point is, can he just say next Thursday, okay, this is far enough? Or is there some clock ticking that you know of?
Well, I mean, there's the speedy trial report and you know, she just asked Donald Trump to provide a speedy trial report, probably for this very specific reason. So she can say, look, we're super far away from anything. I don't need to do anything because I feel like if she sat on this, Jack Smith might actually go to the 11th Circuit and say, we need this decision now. To which Judge Cannon will say, but look, we still have, we've only told 20 days on the 100-day speedy trial clock. We got plenty of time. So I think that that's kind of her game here.
But doesn't the public have a right to a speedy trial also?
Not, oh, we have an interest in speedy justice. I don't think we have a right under the Constitution, but we definitely do. Speedy Trial Act 1974, I think. We do have an interest in speedy justice, and Jack Smith has brought that up in multiple filings, saying, you know, particularly with the immunity decision waiting in the DC trial, that's going to be argued in the Supreme Court in what, 15 days or 21 days, something like that?
The week of the 22nd, yeah.
April 25th. So, you know, he's brought that up several times. He could, after a certain amount of time, saying we're getting close to trial, we have to know well before trial if this is her interpretation of the law. We have to know now, 11th Circuit, writ of mandamus.
Yeah, so let's talk about two other things. You brought up the Supreme Court and the immunity discussion, and that'll begin on the 25th. This is, to some extent, kabuki theater. I don't think anybody expects the Supreme Court to say, oh yeah, you have immunity on everything you want. Go ahead. But what I'm worried about is that the Supreme Court will say, you know, you have immunity when it pertains to something official, and we need to suss that out. So the lower court needs to look at item by item affected by this and determine what's official where there's immunity and what isn't. And, you know, if that takes you a couple of years, God bless you.
Yep. No, that's my fear too. Because I don't think any court, including the district court, Judge Chutkan, or the DC Circuit Court, ruled that Donald Trump was acting as a candidate for office. And so none of these acts could be considered in the outer perimeter of his official duties because he wasn't acting as the president of the United States when he tried to thwart the results of the 2020 election. Now, the DOJ brought it up. I think in my count, they brought up the fact that he was a candidate for office more than 20 times in both of these filings. All three of the filings to the district court, the circuit court, and we haven't seen his Supreme Court brief yet, but I imagine he'll raise that opportunity there as well. And that's where I think this whole thing hinges on. The Supreme Court could say, bro, you were a candidate for office, so we don't need to consider whether or not your official acts are immune. But they didn't do that. They took up this case and they reworded the question at hand. And so I'm very concerned that they will remand this to Judge Chutkan, who, like you said, will then say, all right, well, none of these are official acts. He was acting as a candidate, to which then Donald Trump can appeal. Then it would have to go back up to the DC Circuit Court. And if they win there, Trump could appeal again. And then we're right back at the Supreme Court.
It seems too transparently corrupt to believe, but nonetheless, that seems to be where they're going. It is not the only trial or court event of later this month, however, of note, because we've actually got a real life trial that looks like it's going to start in a few days in New York City. We've got a new witness on the list, Hope Hicks, who's going to appear at that trial. We've got, I guess the court has said immunity issues don't apply here, so you can leave that out. And what do you expect? I mean, to me, this is going to be kind of weirder and uglier than the other cases. This is a criminal trial. He's got to be there for all of it. The way this is going to go is probably going to piss him off to the moon so that he will come out afterwards or go online and say horrible things that could lead to horrible things, which he seems to be allowed to get away with, by the way, in a way that neither you nor I would be. But what are your expectations for that trial?
Well, and you know, I just want to kind of remind everybody, this first criminal trial is for crimes that occurred almost 8 years ago, David. So talk about justice moving slowly but grinding finely. This isn't got anything to do. This is interference in the 2016 election, not interference in the 2020 election. And here we are in 2024. About to go to criminal trial for things that happened in the 2016 election. I don't think it'll go well for him. I think there's a very high chance that he'll be convicted. I know he's trying to delay this every way possible by first subpoenaing the Southern District of New York, the feds, in January for additional discovery, and then telling the judge that the DA had, you know, violated discovery rules and tried to get him sanctioned. Now his argument is that he's got some new evidence that the judge's daughter is compromised, even though this was decided by the ethics committee over a year ago, that the judge didn't have to recuse in this case because of what the jobs of his relatives were. But this is his last ditch effort to delay there. I don't know that that's going to be successful, but you know, we'll see. We'll see what ends up happening.
Soon.
Yeah, I mean, jury selection starts, you know, just here in
11 days, the 15th, yeah.
Something. And jury selection could take a while. It could take a while, but we'll see.
Yeah, I saw some poll today that said 67% of New Yorkers said they could set aside their prejudices and judge fairly. I suspect that's probably right here or anywhere. But I don't think that for one moment Trump or all those around him will stop from denigrating everybody in New York City and say that there's no way that in, you know, a corrupt blue country like New York, he could get a fair trial.
No, right. And it's a little different, too, than I think it's a little more comprehensive, the voir dire process in a criminal trial than it is in a civil trial. I mean, we saw that it didn't take long to seat a jury in either the E. Jean case or the New York Attorney General. Well, New York Attorney General civil fraud trial wasn't in front of a jury, but the E. Jean Carroll case, I think it could take a couple weeks, maybe. We'll see. But he could very well go into the Republican National Convention a convicted felon.
As well he should. The one last question before we wrap up, and I'm so grateful for your time and expertise. I personally think that Judge Scott McAfee in Fulton County, Georgia, who everybody said was, you know, despite being a Republican appointee, was very even-handed and fair and so forth. And despite being very young, I think he's just lost the narrative. I think he's lost control of this thing. I mean, it's like, what happened here? You know, there was this, we went into this lengthy, absurd set of hearings about Fonnie Willis. And now we're what, in appeals of all of that? In some sort of netherworld where we keep relitigating that for a while before we get to anything like a trial? How do you see all that?
I don't know. On one hand, I think it was a lot of that litigation was ridiculous. On the other hand, I can see him wanting to shore up whatever his ruling would be so that it's less vulnerable to appeal on these exact same charges to just kind of get everything in the record before we go to trial. I think he's been, I mean, of course, you know, when we have it to compare to somebody like Judge Cannon, who can't make a ruling from the bench and sits on, you know, fully briefed motion practice for months, you know, entertains the idea of allowing SEPA Section 4 hearings to not be ex parte. I mean, it's kind of, I think for me at least, it's sort of uncharted territory, you know, after following the Mueller investigation for so long. We had very fast trials on, you know, Manafort, Gates, a lot of guilty pleas that came down the pike. And so actually holding Donald Trump accountable or a former president accountable is nothing that we've ever witnessed before. So I don't really have a basis of comparison. You know, I think that I do agree that particularly during the hearings for the disqualification motion, they went down some rabbit holes that I think that could have been nipped in the bud a lot faster, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, they could have just said, look, this is about a conflict of interest. Let's just stick to the conflict of interest.
Right.
You know, as opposed to let's talk about smarmy stuff, you know, because people want to hear about that.
But he did eventually find an appearance of impropriety and said that one of them, Wade or Willis, had to step down. And that's when Wade tendered his resignation and Willis accepted it. And maybe that was the end goal for him for all that, was to eliminate that long shot possibility of an appearance of impropriety. I don't know.
Did you see one piece of evidence that suggested impropriety?
No.
No. Well, I guess my point. You know, I watched it all very carefully. It was kind of entertaining to watch. And at no point was there any evidence that there was impropriety, nor was there evidence that there was a conflict of interest. There was only evidence that there were people who wanted to be outraged over something on this. And that became the centerpiece. And that's not what the law should be about. But
no, I agree. And we didn't see any of that kind of reaction to a Trump motion, a Trump et al. Motion with Judge Angoron or Judge Mershon or Judge Chutkin. You know, they pretty much just shut all that down immediately. Like when they wanted Judge Chutkin to recuse or when they, you know, et cetera. We didn't have prolonged hearings about, you know, all of those issues that were raised, false issues,
right. Meaningless issues. Like about Judge Angoron's clerk or whatever, right? I mean, you know, crazy stuff. Well, look, I'm sure we'll talk again. I think everybody should listen to all your podcasts. People should follow you on Twitter. You're a voice of wisdom and sanity on this, but you know, 85% of the time you don't lose your sense of humor, and and the other 15% of the time is justified given the swill in the Twitterverse. And so I'm always delighted to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you everybody for listening. We'll be back with more, you know, in other podcasts today and tomorrow and on and on. Until then, bye bye.